Mr. Mumford.
Yes, sir.
Could I ask a quick question, please? Were you trial counsel?
I was, Your Honor.
Where did you make a motion to strike on the grounds that there was no force or intimidation?
If I may, could I reserve 5 minutes first?
Yes, sir. 5 minutes.
Thank you. I did not make it during the...
Why are you not barred by 5A18?
Well, 5A18 allows ends of justice...
Okay. So your argument today necessarily is ends of justice?
Well, I think it's also included in my... It's not the first time it's come before the court, before a court, because I made the argument in my closing argument also.
That doesn't count, does it?
I understand that, but it's not out of the whole cloth, as it were, that this comes before the court.
Well, I don't mean to suggest that it is, but the only thing I'm trying to do is narrow this down. So I gather you concede that this argument, intimidation, was not preserved in the trial court, but... You think ends of justice requires it be considered substantively?
Well, I think for good cause and ends of justice, yes.
Okay.
5A18 includes good cause in there. And I would say that it was good cause the fact that I did bring it up.
Well, you brought it up to the jury, not to the court.
I understand that. Well, and candidly, I actually thought I brought it up at the motion to strike, but the record does not reflect that.
No, your motion to strike said... This isn't the guy who robbed the bank or tried to rob the bank.
I do not disagree with what the record shows. My recollection was different.
All right, well.
But nevertheless, so we're at the point of what is intimidation? Clearly, in a robbery, there's a difference in robbery in the vernacular. In the vernacular, we say, my house was robbed, or you were pickpocketed.
This was a jury trial,
wasn't it? This was a jury trial.
And the jury saw the videotape.
Correct, Your Honor.
And the jury heard from the teller.
Correct, Your Honor.
Is not whether or not there was intimidation a question of fact?
Well, it's a matter that has to be presented to the jury.
Yes.
And I would say that what the Commonwealth presented required the jurors to speculate, which is not admissible.
So, are you claiming any evidence that went to the jury was not admissible?
No. Not that it wasn't inadmissible. They didn't put before the jury the fact or the question of whether she was intimidated, Ms. Kerr.
Why'd you argue it in closing argument then, if they didn't put it before the jury?
I did argue that.
No, I said, why did you argue it?
No, I argued that they didn't put it in front of the jurors. That was my argument, was that the intimidation was never presented to the jurors.
I'm sorry, sir. I thought that your argument was, here's what happened. You saw it on videotape. You heard the testimony. But this evidence is insufficient to show intimidation.
Correct. It does not show intimidation. Maybe we're at cross ends here. What I'm saying is that it doesn't show intimidation because they didn't put that evidence of intimidation in front. In other words, there's a requirement for it to be intimidation. It's got to be either violence, which we all agree is not the case here, or it has to be some sort of threat, which did not happen, or a perception of bodily injury.
Okay.
She never said...
And the jury was instructed on that, were they not?
The jury was not given specific instructions as to what intimidation, what the definition of intimidation was.
Maybe my reading of the record is...
What the Commonwealth, and I believe the jury in the court read or interpreted, was that shaken, because she said she was shaken, after engaging my client for approximately 2 minutes, and assuming that he had physical handicaps that prevented him from being able to communicate effectively. And then suddenly he makes a clear statement to her, and she's shaken by that.
You don't claim, I gather, that any of the evidence was improperly admitted?
No, I do not.
Okay.
And so what she doesn't specify, what the Commonwealth doesn't elicit from her, and what she doesn't specify, is that does shaking mean scared of bodily injury? Is that an interpretation of that? Or was she shaken because she was startled that this person who she assumed could not communicate with her was suddenly capable of communicating with her? It's an easy question to follow up on that was not followed up on. And so the Commonwealth leaves it to the jury to decide that her being... And she doesn't say scared. It's just shaken. Does that mean...
But can't a fact finder consider what the term, from their reasonable experience, shaken means? In other words, some people might interpret shaken mean that I was startled. Some people might say that I hear the term shaken, that suggests that I'm scared. Some people use the term shake me up. That means that they had an experience. In other words, people have different definitions of different terminologies. And I guess what Judge Haley is getting to is, couldn't a reasonable fact finder interpret the term as observing the demeanor of the witness, conclude that when she said that she was shaken, that she was either scared or intimidated? Couldn't a reasonable fact finder draw that conclusion?
Could they? Yes, but it's a two-step process.
Yes, sir.
Because it's not just, were they scared? Shaken means scared. Mm-hmm. But it was also, were they shaken or scared as a result of the issue, the robbery, or were they shaken or scared because suddenly this person who they thought could
not... The stimuli which caused her to be shaken is uncontroverted. It is the engagement that she had with your client.
I would disagree with the court with that. I would say that it's the stimuli is the engagement, but is it because he's now speaking from a person that she did not believe had that capacity, or is it because he said, this is a robbery?
Well, but the jury saw on videotape exactly what happened, didn't they?
To the extent that that it's a black and white video without sound, yes. But that's not, there was no testimony or evidence of any sort of a gesture, hand movement, anything like that. And this is along the same lines as the Bivens case, we would say, where the perpetrator reached across. We don't even have any gesticulation towards her that would have caused a reaction, which the court in Bivens said that reaction, where that person said, that victim said, I was scared. I physically jumped back. We don't have that in this case.
Do you have to have that, though?
It seems like Bivens indicated that there had to be something that tied the two.
Well, some objective circumstances suggest that she was intimidated, or that the victim in the case was intimidated or scared.
And my argument is that her testimony did not rise to that level.
Okay. All right. Well, let's put it in context of this case. If a person's a bank teller, and obviously as a bank teller, they're aware that certain situations can arise. And they're doing their job normally, and someone comes up and is really not communicating with them, which causes them concern. All right, maybe you hadn't gotten to the point of being scared or intimidated now. And then makes some sort of eye contact, is what the evidence says. He sees with his eyes. And then he says, both drawers 60 seconds. And you can see now the thing is accelerating. You know, it's not just a disquieting situation because there's someone that's not really communicating with me, but now I'm being confronted with what I believe may be a robbery. All right? It's pretty obvious. Both drawers 60 seconds.
Yes.
Then you hear, keep quiet, it's a robbery. Then it seems to me that you're not uncomfortable anymore. You know that you're involved in a situation. And let me finish. And her response is that I was shaken by all of this. Why isn't that enough?
And your guy's wearing a mask.
Which she testified did not prevent her from seeing his face.
Well, it was a surgical mask. Which
it was hanging down here. That's why she said she was able to see him completely
all right.
Through it. But again, I would just go back to that. There's no clarification on her testimony that what is it that caused her to be shaken. Was it that suddenly this person that she'd been dealing with can now speak? Where is the fear of bodily injury? Where is this inherent in it? And that's
both,
why I started
both drawers 60 seconds.
But that doesn't mean that there's any bodily threat to her herself. She's in a partitioned area.
So you don't think it's reasonable to for a person to conclude that when someone is coming up to their counter and says both drawers 60 seconds and they have a surgical mask, that they should not be put on notice that something could go bad?
I think that that's an element that was required to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, and that the simple follow-up question by the Commonwealth would have solved that. And what we're doing is we're asking the court to allow the Commonwealth to slide on that.
So you would say, the Commonwealth should have said, were you scared?
Or why were you shaking?
And the objection would have been objection leading.
If we get to that hypothetical, then they could have still explained it. Why were you shaking would have been perfect.
All right, sir. You're in your rebuttal time, sir.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Victoria Johnson for the Commonwealth.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll speak briefly to the procedural. I'm sorry.
You can actually kind of put it down. That way we can hear
better?
You. Yes,
okay.
Ma'am.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I could only see that. I'll speak briefly to the procedural default argument. I maintain that this is barred under 518 for the reasons stated in my brief. As I recall, the good cause standard involves an attorney not having an opportunity to make the necessary objection or motion to strike. Obviously, there was an opportunity to make a proper motion to strike here. It just wasn't done. As far as ends of justice, I believe it's the Redmond case, and I apologize if I am remembering the incorrect case, but I believe that case talks about mere insufficiency of the evidence not being enough for good cause, or pardon me, for the ends of justice. Instead, as later cases explained, there has to be affirmative evidence that a criminal act did not occur or that the defendant was convicted of something that's not a crime. Excuse me. So unless the court has questions about the procedural default, I'll
I think we understand the procedural part of the case.
Thank you, Your Honors. As to the merits of the case, I flipped through the joint appendix briefly to see if there was a jury instruction on intimidation. I didn't put my fingers on it, but I decided it's kind of a big joint appendix, and I really didn't have time to look. So I apologize. I don't recall that. However, I think the court's earlier statement is well taken, that a prior fact has a common sense understanding of what the term intimidation means. It's not a strange term. I think that a fact finder can find that just based on their common sense. Here, the evidence shows that the defendant, and I'll be brief because I think the court's familiar with the record, that the defendant came up to the teller window and didn't say anything, making the teller wonder if perhaps he had a physical problem and couldn't speak, handed her a note that said, both drawers, 60 seconds. I submit that the time limit of 60 seconds, it kind of implies a threat. You know, what's going to happen to me in 60 seconds? Then whispered to her to be quiet because it was a robbery. And while the teller testified that she was pretty shaken, that wasn't the sole extent of her testimony that the prior fact could rely upon. She also testified that she forgot that her top drawer was broken.
She panicked.
She panicked. She dropped her key. She was scared enough that she, you know, kind of went to pieces and dropped her key and bent down on the floor to get it, and by then the defendant was gone, which is obviously an attempted robbery and not a completed robbery. And I submit that's more than sufficient evidence to prove intimidation. As to the defendant's reliance on the Bivens case, in the Bivens case, the issue in that case was that the taking was not accomplished through an intimidation. Instead, the store clerk there was just standing behind the counter, and the defendant reached over and grabbed the cash box, and him reaching over the cash box kind of startled her. But
there was no interaction between the defendant and the victim in that case.
Yes, Your Honor. And for a robbery, the taking has to be accomplished by the intimidation or force of threat. And that's my position, Your Honors. If the court has questions, I'm happy to answer them.
I think we understand your argument, counsel.
Thank you very much. We ask that you affirm.
All right, so you have the remainder of your time.
Well, just briefly, Your Honors.
Yes, sir.
With respect to the intimidation instruction, I just reviewed the transcript again. There is no instruction regarding intimidation. instruction?
Well, the instruction on robbery certainly included it, did it not?
It included the word intimidation, but as and this is my next point, was that intimidation in the vernacular doesn't necessarily mean intimidation in the legal. And what I mean by that is in the legal we say it's fear bodily injury.
Well, were you saying the instruction was an error?
It appears that, I wouldn't say it was an error, I said an additional instruction of intimidation was probably necessary.
Did you offer one?
I did not, Your Honor.
Right.
But I would just state that a fear of bodily injury is not necessarily encompassed in what the general public knows of when we say intimidation. There are other means of intimidation, financial, pecuniary, along those lines, which would not rise.
Counsel, it's obvious you're a zealous advocate, and I would assume that your theory of the case, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, would be that the Commonwealth's going to have a hard time proving this intimidation aspect of the case. That was one of your theories of the case, correct?
Yes.
And if that is indeed the case, it would seem to me that you would want to hammer this home, and the way that you hammer it home is to make sure that an instruction is in there or some discussion is made to the jury in the form of an instruction that intimidation is the key to accomplishing the objective of determining the guilt of my client. And so therefore, I'm going to highlight it by providing you some reference points as to the law with regard to intimidation.
Two things on that point, Your Honor. We're required to exchange jury instructions in advance.
Yes, sir.
I was not contemplating that matter, the intimidation matter, until at trial when it failed to be raised. So, in other words, I did not expect the Commonwealth to allow this matter to slide, to slip through the cracks from my perspective. So, A, if I had anticipated that, by providing the jury instruction ahead of time, I would have done my client a disservice by alerting the Commonwealth to a defense strategy. If that's the case.
So the case is what it is, and I understand your point that you don't want to give up a strategy to the government, but considering you had a preliminary hearing.
Well, and secondly, the strategy didn't arise until, I mean, candidly, when you're in the middle of a trial, strategies appear that you had not contemplated of in advance. And that was the case
We've been there before.
In this particular case, yes, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking to myself, why aren't they ensuring that this is, that she was fearful of what happened. And when it did not occur, that's where I came to.
All right, sir. I think we understand your argument. We appreciate it. We'll come down and greet counsel in the next case.